This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
This is Background Briefing on ABC Radio National. Last year, we investigated some of the uncertainties and unanswered questions around the Access Card, a new national card for Australians. Over Christmas, draft legislation for the card was put out for public consultation, and this week there's been considerable outcry from the banks on one hand, because they think it's too restrictive, and privacy advocates, who say it's not restrictive enough. The head of the government's own task force on the card, Professor Alan Fells, has come out with strong objections too. So today's Background Briefing revisits the earlier program. Hello, I'm Sharona Coutts. The new card is called the Access Card, and the idea is to replace all government cards and the Medicare card with one single card. Last year, the minister in charge was Joe Hockey, and at the time he was, as you'll hear, selling it as something like an iPod or a car or somewhere to store your shopping list. What it really is, his critics say, is an ID card. And we've tried that before, 20 years ago.
This is PM. Good evening from Paul Murphy. Federal Parliament resumed this afternoon for the final 2 weeks of sittings for 1986, and the opposition confirmed it will move with the Democrats to block two key pieces of government legislation in the Senate, the Australia Card Bill and legislation...
With a federal election coming this year, the campaign to launch a new national card is already underway.
You may have heard that the Australian government is proposing to introduce a single card for people to receive health and social services.
The government's already put $1 billion into the project, which it says will modernise government services. And if everything goes to plan, the Access Card will be up and running sometime in 2008.
The card could replace up to 17 existing cards, including your Medicare card, Centrelink benefit and concession cards, and veterans cards. It'll be part of a secure system which provides benefits for you and the community as a whole.
So is this a new version of the doomed Australia card? There's a semantic argument about how you define an ID card, but the government says no matter what definition you use, this is not an ID card. But could it become one? We know that the way cards are used changes all the time, like a driver's licence, which started off simply to prove whether a person was entitled to drive a car. But over time, it's become much more than that. And today, you can use it as a proof of ID for things like catching planes and opening a bank account. That process, where something morphs in new and unexpected ways, has a name. It's called function creep. And it's a big worry for fans and foes of the Access Card alike. The head of the government's task force on the Access Card is Professor Alan Fells.
Function creep refers to the fact that a card or something else is set up for a particular function or purpose, and then over time it acquires many, many other functions.
And Professor Fells says there's precedent for function creep creeping into other national ID cards.
For example, in the UK, in 1939, they introduced an ID card with three purposes about not avoiding being called up to prove you weren't German and so on. And it was said by 1951 that it had 39 different functions before it was abolished.
The former Minister for Human Services, Joe Hockey, said the government is serious about stopping function creep because it's often to blame for huge cost blowouts and even project failures.
Everyone comes up with a good idea to add to the project. And so what starts off as a racehorse ends up as a camel because everyone thinks that, you know, you'd be more comfortable having two humps and, it'd be good if it didn't have to drink too much water. And, that's why we are very clear about the objective of the card. We are laying down some very clear principles. We are clearly illustrating what it is going to do. And therefore, let's do it.
And the reason this racehorse could be particularly prone to morphing into a camel is because it's no ordinary horse. As well as having your name, photo, signature, and a new individual number on the face of the card. Embedded inside it, there's a state-of-the-art microchip, a mini-computer, that can store and use data. So it's not a swipe card like we're used to. This new generation of cards are called smart cards, and an example is the SIM card in your mobile phone. And because it's basically a SIM card, you can load information onto it, change it, and use it for other things. And that worries critics from all sides of politics. Tim Warner is a Liberal Party official from Victoria and now heads up the Access Card No Way campaign. He says there's a groundswell of opposition to the Access Card coming from the grassroots of the Liberal Party in Victoria.
The State Council proceeded to pass a resolution saying that all forms of ID card were an anathema to the Liberal Party and that they did not conform to Liberal principles and that we shouldn't have them.
Tim Warner says the government should be listening to its own members.
Certainly the party's general thrust is we don't like access cards, we don't like ID cards, and I think that the parliamentary party is actually not taking notice of a large part of the organisational wing.
One of the people who lined up against the Australia card back in 1986 was Graham Greenleaf, Professor of Cyber Law at the University of New South Wales. He says he sees a lot of similarities between the old Australia card and the new Access card.
Well, it's surprising, given how adamant the government is that this is not an ID card, just how similar its key features are. And I think at this stage the government is getting away with it because people's memories are relatively short and they don't remember how much the Australia card had features that tried to stop it looking like an ID card as well.
In a paper he wrote called Quacking Like a Duck, Professor Greenleaf points out that both the Australia card and the proposed Access card were primarily about cracking down on welfare fraud. And he says they have other things in common.
For example, it was supposedly not compulsory for people to have an Australia card. But you wouldn't be able to claim Medicare benefits if you didn't have an Australia card. And that's very similar to what's being proposed here with the so-called Access card.
Debates over ID cards pop up time and again. And generally, there's a pattern. Governments love them, and oppositions love to hate them. John Howard is a good example of this. In the 1970s, as Treasurer in the Fraser government, he pushed for an ID card. But then, as opposition leader in the mid-80s, he totally opposed the Australia card. Here he is on PM in 1987.
And we have come down against the present ID card for three fundamental reasons. The first is the enormous invasion of privacy. The second is that the savings and the advantages of it are not great. And thirdly, and most importantly, the cost of it.
And John Howard said what really turned him against ID cards was the possibility of abuse.
A group of officials was sent overseas to North America, I think, to see how the American Social Security card system worked. They came back and gave a very negative report. I seem to remember the verdict of some at the time was that the mafia would have control of the system within 24 hours.
Yesterday's mafia are today's hackers. And former Human Services Minister Joe Hockey says that's why the government will be using the best technology available. But there are still no guarantees the system is secure.
Today, the most secure storage for information is an encrypted mainframe computer with limited access and devices that detect if someone is inappropriately accessing information. Now, having said all of that, I know what you're going to ask me next. You're going to say, come on, Joe, are you going to guarantee no one can get into it? I can't do that. I'd be mad to, right? But you know what? The only information we're going to hold is what already sits on the face of your driver's license. That's the only information we're going to have in the secure database. So if someone tries to break into that database, and no doubt someone will, they try and break into the honeypot of Centrelink, $60 billion and they try and break into Medicare, $17 billion every day, right? We get it every day. But if they break into this, the only thing they're going to find out is what already they can find out by stealing your wallet or your purse.
Things have changed since those comments from Joe Hockey in December. Now the new draft legislation requires more information than what's on your licence, like your place of birth, your legal name, and biometric mathematical scans of your photo. And on top of the information you have to provide, you could also choose to add a lot more than that to your card. The government's leaving some free space on the card's chip, and by connecting to a home computer, you can add whatever information you want to the card. For instance, medical information, which could help in emergencies, especially if you're hurt or unconscious and can't tell ambulance or hospital staff important things yourself.
But it's up to you whether you put that information on. And importantly, I, Joe Hockey, and the government do not want that information stored on our secure database. So we're saying, okay, let's hear from the public. How do you want to do it? Maybe the AMA will set up a database so that, you know, a doctor puts the information in, therefore it's reliable for a doctor at the hospital. Or maybe a pharmacist can put it in, or maybe Australia Post or someone. But it's up to you guys. You might want to put your bank account details on. You might want to put your shopping list on it. And some people have asked for that in our wide community consultation. So, you know, we're basically giving every Australian a mini iPod and saying you can put information on it that you want and you control it.
But public opposition to the card is growing.
Now, you've got one for a really good reason, but hey.
But you're going to have to carry it around in your pocket. Oh, no.
A few weeks ago, there was a public forum about the card in a high-rise corporate office in Sydney's glitzy financial district.
We've got four speakers and they're each going to speak for about 15 minutes and then we'll have
time. It was run by the Public Interest Advocacy Centre, and a room full of people had gathered to listen to a discussion about the card.
We've got people here from Background Briefing to tape the questions and answers. I ask you to welcome Anna Johnson, the Chair of the Australian Privacy Foundation.
I'd like to thank Robin and PIAC for inviting me to address this forum on the smart card.
Anna Johnston now runs the brand new No ID card campaign, which will kick off this year. She also used to be Deputy Privacy Commissioner of New South Wales. Background Briefing caught up with her later.
One of the issues I guess we would like to bring out in public debate is, of course, that it's not just about the card, it's not just a bit of plastic in your wallet. There's a massive database that will sit behind it, and it's that national population database, which the government is calling the Secure Customer Registration System, that will hold information on all Australians. I mean, we do understand some of the government's reassurances that the databases, the customer databases, if you like, Medicare database will be different to the Centrelink database, will be different to Veterans database, and that's all fine and good. But sitting on top of all of that will be this national population database, and that's actually where I think the vast majority of the risks come from.
And she rejects the idea that the new card is voluntary.
We don't believe that this is effectively voluntary. Unless you're extremely wealthy and can afford to live without Medicare or PBS subsidised medicines or ever seek any assistance from the government, you will need a card. So, first of all, it's not really voluntary, and the government is budgeting on the assumption that, you know, 16 million adults will get a card. The database, however, will have information on children as well. So that's the 20 million, the whole population.
The government anticipated many of these sorts of concerns, so they established a consumer and privacy task force to consult with the community and give independent reports to the minister about how to minimise privacy problems and maximise convenience. The task force head is former ACCC chairman Alan Fells. Last November, he released the task force's first report with 26 recommendations to the minister about the proposed access card. Nearly all of them were about giving the public more information, clarifying, and doing more research. But there were key recommendations that the minister flatly rejected. Alan Fells.
Yeah, well, we recommended that neither the number nor the digitised signature should appear on the card. It should be in the chip. We are concerned about anything that takes us closer to the position where Australians and other users of the card, for that matter, have a unique number, that number 6400. Now, having said that, the fact is that the card has to have a number and it will be on the chip. So it would be better, other things being equal, if the number weren't on the face of the card. But don't be under any illusions, that card will still have and has to have a number.
Now that the government's draft legislation has been released, Professor Fels and his task force have more details about the plans, and some new concerns have come up. Background Briefing spoke with him again this week on the phone about the fact that the government now plans to record your place of birth in the database as well.
We are opposed to a person's place of birth being put on the register. We've not heard any convincing arguments for it at this stage, so it seems unnecessary for the purpose of accessing any benefits or entitlements that we are aware of. So we can't see any rationale for it at this stage.
Professor Fels says the most serious problem in the legislation is not what it says, but what it doesn't say, because there are no rules about the person in charge of managing the sensitive information on the huge new database and deciding who gets a card and whose card is cancelled. The person will be called the secretary, and Fels says he or she will have a lot of power.
Yes, we think that the secretary, or even more, the secretary's delegate, because some of it's going to be delegated, is making decisions which at times transcend mere administrative matters, and there should be some rights of appeal, and that's not provided for at the moment.
So if the secretary makes a decision that could affect someone's entitlements, as it stands, we don't know how the government intends to deal with that.
I believe at the moment it can be taken for granted that there would be rights of appeal to the administrative law tribunals. But we're concerned that that is not a very convenient means of appeal for the ordinary citizen, and especially disadvantaged people who are obviously big users of Centrelink.
A lot of this is still a moving feast, and it's almost certain that we'll see more versions of the bill before it goes to Parliament in March. But there are some things that the government looks unlikely to change because, says the minister who kick-started the project, it's all about convenience. Joe Hockey.
The reason why we have the number on the card is because, for example, this card is going to cover Veterans Affairs, and a lot of older Australians prove their identity over the phone to Veterans Affairs by reading out a number. And we field around 400,000 calls a day in human services. And so when we say to people, okay, sorry, who's calling? They'll say, I'm Joe Hockey. And how do I know you're Joe Hockey? Do you have your access card number? And you read out your access card number and then say, okay, a couple of questions, mother's maiden name, et cetera, et cetera. So it is a way of helping to deliver better services over the phone and over the internet. And it is fundamental to our ability to make things convenient for people.
But convenience can come at the expense of security. And privacy advocate Anna Johnston says it severely compromises the privacy of the card because anyone, including business, can record your individual number and use it for their own purposes.
They don't need access to the database because they've got the number that's on the card. And this is why I think Joe Hockey is so wrong in rejecting the Consumer and Privacy Task Force's recommendation to take the number off. You've got all the great security around the database, a lot of security around the chip on the PIN, and then he's going and printing the keys to your identity on the face of the card. So no one needs access to the database or a smart card chip reader. They just take Anna Johnston number 12345678910 on the card. They put that in their customer database and they can link that up with information from Qantas or Australia Post or government agencies. So that's what I meant when I said, you've got this smart technology and lots of data security, and then if you put dumb business rules on top of it, you undermine the whole thing.
But the new access card also has a lot of fans. One of them is Steve Wilson, an IT security and privacy expert. He's the managing director of Lockstep Consulting, which he runs, accompanied by his cat Mir, from his home in one of Sydney's suburbs under the flight path. Like lots of IT bods, Steve Wilson loves the smarts on the card, and he's got lots of ideas about what to do with the free space on it. But he says talk of iPods and shopping lists is a distraction.
It's terrific to have some spare real estate and some spare capacity in these cards made available for public use. But I'd like a more sophisticated vision that says this isn't just an extra 20 kilobytes of memory that I can play with. I'd like to see card function that was made available for third-party use. I'd like to see memory made available with memory protections. I'd like protected memory that could be used to hold health identifiers and personal credentials. I'd like to see this technology used for electronic voting and electronic census collection by using the spare capacity in the card.
This isn't fantasy stuff. Smart cards really are that smart. In fact, the card's chip can even detect when it's being used suspiciously and shut itself down. So they can actually stop fraud before it happens. That's how credit cards work in Europe, where they had huge problems with credit card fraud. Steve Wilson.
The computer inside keeps count of what happens every day. It keeps count of the daily transaction limit. And if a smart card detects on its own that it's been involved with over €1,000 worth of transactions, it will actually shut itself down, or it will flag the fact to the merchant, or it will create some sort of exception so that that can be investigated.
And the Access card could be used in Australia to log medical transactions the same way. So in the case of Medicare fraud or doctor shopping, where a person has gone to a string of doctors for a large amount of drugs like pethidine, the card could tally the prescriptions itself and shut down, or notify the central agencies so they can investigate the person later on. And none of that has to go to a mountainous central database. It could all happen on the tiny chip in the card. And Steve Wilson says another trick in the smart card's bag is to make home computing more secure. To use our Access cards at home, the government will ask us to buy a $25 card reader and connect it to our computers. Steve Wilson shows me how it works.
So I've inserted the smart card into the reader. The smart card has determined that it's talking to a laptop and it's now asking the laptop to get my PIN number. So the software's come up and it's asking me to enter my passphrase.
What Steve Wilson is demonstrating is part of a new wave of improved IT security principles, and smart cards are the centrepiece. It's called two-factor authentication. Steve Wilson explains.
It's based on something that you have and something that you know. Most authentication in the computer world these days is what you know. It's a password, it's some sort of secret, it's your PIN number. Two-factor authentication says, look, you need something physical as well, something that's difficult to lose or something that's difficult to copy. A smart card, for all intents and purposes, is impossible to copy. There are computer codes inside the chip that nobody reads or writes, but the smart card manufacturer has put these master codes into the chip. Those master codes can't be read. Even if I lose this card in the street, even if I lose it with my PIN number, copying the entire contents of the chip is impossible for any ordinary hacker.
But there are extraordinary hackers out there too. And their activities are watched by Australia's Computer Crime Emergency Response Unit, OSCERT.
Hello, hi Jamie.
Hi, how are you?
Well, how are you?
Which operates out of a nondescript third floor office at the University of Queensland.
So this is it, hey?
This is the OSCERT, yes.
Jamie Gillespie is a senior security analyst at OSCERT. He says this is where big organisations can turn when they discover that their database has been compromised or that a hacker has broken into their website and defaced it, posting abusive or political messages instead of the normal text. And the team is always on call to respond to those sorts of IT emergencies, and they have to be, according to Jamie, because hackers and IT experts battle each other every day in what he calls the IT arms race.
The arms race that we see in computer terms and on the internet is basically that the protection mechanisms that people are putting in place, such as firewalls, antivirus software, are now increasingly having to become more complex, as well as new additional protection tools as the attackers and hackers and people trying to do malicious things on the internet are developing new attack techniques.
And the attackers swarm like bees to things called honeypots, large stores of valuable information, like a database.
Well, of course, whenever you have a large database of information that would be valuable to an attacker, you will have a significant number of attacks targeted towards it. If there was a large database that could be used for identity theft of a larger scale, such as stealing someone's complete identity, that, of course, would be a very high value to some of the criminals on the internet, both in Australia and overseas. So a database such as that with internet connectivity would be a prime target for attacks.
And he says the government's idea of using home computers to update access cards or log on to government sites could create a weak link.
With the home computers being sometimes running without antivirus software, without firewalls, and maybe not even being updated on a regular basis, that is an easy target for attackers to break in. And all you have to do is look at the number of computers that get infected with viruses. A simple virus may just try and spread from computer to computer, but a more malicious one can be a type of Trojan or what we call a rootkit that gains access and hides itself, but still captures every keystroke that you type into the computer and keeping a record of every website that you go to and every type of other computer that you access. With that type of information sitting on a home user's computer, it could actually subvert any other technologies that are used to gain access to a website, thus stealing the information used for further financial gain or identity theft.
That means a clever hacker could effectively watch over your shoulder as you access the database and possibly use that information for their own gain. With all these risks, Jamie says smart cards won't necessarily stop the hackers.
Anyone can use a smart card with a very poorly implemented system that allows attackers still to sit in the middle of the transaction and modify the information. So unfortunately, until the system is actually deployed, it will be hard to determine how strong the implementation is.
This is Background Briefing on ABC Radio National. I'm Sharona Coots. On the other side of the world, a fight over ID cards has been raging.
What's more, the advent of the new biometric technology has completely changed the argument in how we combat these challenges.
That's British Prime Minister Tony Blair. He's been forced to defend his government's ambitious project for a national ID card.
It means the national identity system has benefits it never had before, and it explains also why it's sensible to do this now.
The British card has been in the works for years. For their system, they're asking everyone to present to a registration booth where they'll take biometric scans of everyone's 10 fingerprints and both their irises and put that information in a new central database. A major poll published in The Telegraph found that public support for the card is plummeting, and that millions of British citizens say they'll be refuseniks, refusing to register for the system even if they face fines or jail. Edgar Whitley is one of Britain's leading authorities on the UK card. He's an academic at the London School of Economics, and he says that although the British ID card is very different to the access card, they had similar beginnings.
The history of the proposals actually goes back until around about 2002, when the UK government issued a consultation on what they called at the time entitlement cards. So looking at a card that would confirm that you were entitled to various social security, etc. Benefits.
And then function creep set in.
Over time, and partly as a result of that consultation, the government changed its proposals and in 2005 proposed legislation into the UK Parliament for a national identity cards scheme. And this is a scheme whereby initially on a voluntary basis, but with the intention very much to make it compulsory, every UK resident and anybody who is staying in the UK for more than 3 months would initially be encouraged, but over the long term required, to register with the government and receive a identity card.
The UK project is going to be extremely expensive. In Australian dollars, the government has budgeted $14 billion. But Edgar Whitley says the cost could be anywhere from $25 to $50 billion, depending on whether it goes well or terribly wrong. So the government has come up with some ways to get their costs back.
For a fee, organisations like banks can use the system to check your identity before you open an account or do an important transaction. That's an income stream for the government. But at the same time, says Edgar Whitley, it does raise concerns.
But what's perhaps most ominous about the proposals is that every time you formally check someone's identity using the identity card, more than just looking to see if the photo looks like the person who's presenting it, if you formally check the card, a record is kept on the National Identity Register in the form of an audit trail saying, on this particular occasion, this institution or this organization checked the identity of that particular person. So if you open a bank account, they check your identity card, a record is kept that on this particular occasion, this bank checked or verified this person's identity. So potentially forming a fairly detailed list of all the times that your identity was verified, and potentially also allowing checking whose identity was also verified at the same location at around about the same time. So you could get patterns of who had registered. You're using it to check IDs for going into a bar, then you could see who else was in the bar at the same time, which has the potential for being misused and drawing inferences that perhaps are inappropriate.
Those inferences could be valuable to police or terrorism investigators. They could, though, also intrude on the movements of innocent people. And the possibility for abuse of that power in the hands of corrupt officials or a draconian government has made the project unpopular with the British public. In any case, the scheme has already been passed by Parliament, and Tony Blair says it will be up and running in about 2 years' time. But Edgar Whitley says there are so many internal problems, the ID card could fall over completely.
The government claimed time and again that everything was going fine. However, in July of 2006, after the Act was actually passed, senior civil servants sent emails which were then leaked to a Sunday newspaper claiming there was real concerns about the likelihood of the scheme succeeding, that they were setting themselves up for failure. The headline said, the ID card scheme is doomed. The procurement process for the actual scheme, the buying the computer systems, etc., has not yet begun. And yet the Prime Minister is saying that this scheme will be up and running for the first UK citizens by 2009.
All over the world, there are many versions of smart cards for all sorts of purposes. And in many places, they work well, and people like them. Hong Kong, for instance. It might be the smart card capital of the world.
Smart ID card with a computer chip is here. It's more than an ID card.
And in the last few years, they've moved from their old national ID cards to smart IDs.
Hong Kong Post e-cert embedded into it. By the end of 2004, you can also use it for automated immigration clearance. Smart ID. Smart idea.
Hong Kong is used to central government, and they have a long history of state ID cards going back over 50 years. This was just the newest one. And now banks there have started piggybacking on the ID card to use it for banking as well. This convergence of interest between government and business is an important part of the backstory of cards. It's a multi-billion dollar industry, with heavy hitters like Sony and Siemens and all the big credit card companies, all key players on the smart card scene. And for them, national ID cards are the next big thing. At their recent annual conference in Paris, the smart card industry met, and the hot topic was how ID cards could be a new market for one of their main products, SIM cards.
The sort of background of the whole industry, so it'd be amazing if it weren't.
Derek Robinson was at the conference. He's a principal analyst at IMS Research, an electronics market research firm based in London. He says the existing SIM card market is saturated because Western countries are chock full of mobile phones. So the companies know the real growth area is in ID cards.
So the smart card community, apart from looking for relief from upgrades of SIM cards, are also looking at two other potentially very large markets. One is what I would call state, government, public sector, secure identity. Passports, driving licenses, health service entitlement cards, work permits, that sort of thing, which also could, in the fullness of time, rise to numbers like national populations.
So the millions, the tens of millions.
Tens of millions, for example, of UK passports and UK driving licenses sitting out there.
These new cards will be expensive, but they also have the potential to generate huge profits.
And the requirements on security, the requirements for privacy, the necessity that these are not counterfeited or fraudulently used is such that relatively high specifications and relatively high costs will be associated with this market.
I'm Sharona Coots, and this is Background Briefing on ABC Radio National. And from a high-rise in North Sydney, the start of Sydney's Silicon Valley, the smart card market is being watched closely too. These are the offices of leading international IT analysts, Gartner. One of their research directors is Robin Simpson. He says that the chips aren't a new technology. They've actually been around for 20 years, but because they're expensive to make, they haven't caught on. Until now.
The biggest problem in smart cards in history has been the sort of the chicken and egg problem of a smart card's not very useful unless you can use it everywhere, but nobody's prepared to spend the money to provide the infrastructure so that you can use it anywhere until there's a lot of smart cards. So all kinds of smart card projects have been tried in small scale, but nobody's ever found the right kind of application that will mean that everybody finds a use for a smart card, and therefore all the economics work from the point of view of how much it costs to make a card and how much it costs to install the infrastructure to make it actually usable.
In other words, they need big projects to give them a good economy of scale. And it's not necessarily ID cards. Often, critical mass actually starts with public transport. On a hot Brisbane afternoon, Background Briefing meets Luke Fransman. He's the general manager of Translink, the Queensland government authority that's running the Brisbane pilot program for their smart cards. Luke takes Background Briefing on a test run. Luke, can you just describe where we're standing right now and what we're about to do?
Well, we're standing at a bus stop waiting for one of the buses. It's a 690. And we're going to catch that bus to the Sandgate rail station. We're going to use our smart card, we're going to touch on the system and touch off the bus and then move over to the train station and we'll then touch on the train and catch a train down to Brisbane. The pilot's being undertaken in this part of Brisbane, but also in Redcliffe. So it's only particular services that go through this part of Brisbane. Redcliffe is an area of about 50,000 people that we're running the pilot on all the bus services in the Redcliffe area and on the train stations, the train lines that feed Redcliffe.
And what's the idea behind it?
Well, in 2004 we integrated ticketing in southeast Queensland, so we introduced a paper ticket that allowed you to travel across all the three modes in southeast Queensland, so bus, train and ferry. And the second stage of integrated ticketing is the introduction of a smart card. And the smart card will enable people to store value, so to put value on the card and then to use the card for travelling around the system.
The Brisbane pilot has been going for over 6 months and has a budget of $60 million. About 200 people are volunteering to be part of it. Before the system comes online sometime next year, Translink is ironing out the glitches with their contractors, Cubic. We've now arrived at Sandgate Station. Now we're just walking up to a big vending machine here. How does this work into the pilot?
Well, the vending machine at the moment is where people add value to their cards. So you can touch the screen and...
But the screen isn't working. It flickers a couple of times and then, weirdly, a Microsoft startup screen springs up as if a home PC has suddenly invaded the ticket machine.
What's happening there, Mark?
Luke turns to another TransLink person who's come along with us on the trip.
This one's frozen. I'd say the touch screen's frozen if we present a card.
Cancel?
See, it's actually detected my card, but the touch screen is frozen. Right. There's a known issue with the driver on the touch screen.
Right.
Okay. It won't respond until it's been reset.
So we have to get them out to reset? Would they be coming?
We have to tell Cubic.
Right.
Someone telephones the contractor Cubic to find out what's going on with the known issue. After waiting around for a couple of minutes, Luke tells Background Briefing what's happening.
So we've actually been taken out of service centrally, and someone will be out to fix this now. That's part of the pilot as well, is actually testing the performance of our contractor to make sure that issues like this are identified, and then they come out and rectify those issues as quickly as possible, and they have a key performance indicator to meet as part of the contract to deliver that.
So they've just been contracted for the trial period?
No, they're contracted for the whole system. So they're contracted, A, to deliver the system, to put out all of this equipment, but also the operations of the system for a 10-year period.
Australia's national access card is going to be much more complex than a transport system, and a glitch on a national scale could cause serious problems for people using Medicare or other services. If the database was breached, it's possible the whole system would have to go offline until the problem was solved. Big as it is, the government wants to start the system by 2008, only a year or so away. And they want over 16 million cards issued and working by 2010. Former Human Services Minister Joe Hockey.
From around 2008, we will ask Australians who want the card to go into a Centrelink Medicare office, probably also Australia Post. We're still looking at that. And you need to take in a certain amount of detail to prove who you are. We'll take a photo, as you do with a driver's licence now. And then after a period of time, we'll send you back the card. Now, we're still working through the mechanics and logistics of that. 32,000 people a day.
That's a large number.
It is a big number.
Are you going to bring on new staff to manage
that? Yes, we've budgeted for all that in the $1.1 billion that's been allocated by the government.
How much time are you estimating it's going to take each person to register?
Oh, look, there are various estimates. We're still working through the logistics of it.
What do the estimates range from?
I'm reluctant to say, but...
Because it's important, isn't it? It's a very ambitious timetable.
Some people say it's an ambitious timetable. You know what? I'm ambitious to save taxpayers' money.
The tendering process started in December, and millions or potentially billions of dollars are at stake. But the access card could also turn into a political liability for the government because this is an election year. And 20 years ago, the Australia card brought about a double dissolution. Opposition groups are springing up and there are already rumblings from the government backbench. But when Background Briefing spoke to him in December, Minister Joe Hockey wasn't worried.
No, look, I don't see this as an election issue. It might become an election issue. The legislation is going to the parliament. So, if there's political issues to be made, I'd expect it would be made during the legislative phase. I would even go so far as to expect that the Labor Party would probably support it.
Labor doesn't have an in-principle objection to the card, but when Background Briefing spoke to the then Shadow Minister Kelvin Thompson, he was concerned about how the government is putting the card in place.
Labor believes that there can be benefits from change, but if we're going to have change, it needs to be on the basis that the government has addressed the cost-benefit issues and has addressed the legitimate privacy concerns of Australians. So far, it's failed to address either. In relation to cost-benefit, it claims there will be a saving of the order of $3 billion over 10 years, but it refuses to release the assumptions on which that claim is based, so it simply expects Australians to take it on trust. In relation to the privacy issues, it had a privacy impact assessment carried out by Clayton Utz, but again, it's refused to release that document. Now, it can't expect Australians to trust it if it's not prepared to trust Australians in turn.
There's an elephant in the room in this debate. People argue about whether it's an ID card and whether the technology is secure. But there's something else going on too. It's a gut reaction that many people have at the very thought of ID cards and databases. And we know that privacy breaches happen. Centrelink found that 600 of its staff had inappropriately accessed over 700 records. A similar story happened with the tax office, and again with Child Protection Services. Different people frame their objections in different ways. Head of the Access Card No Way campaign, Liberal Party member Tim Warner, puts it in ideological terms.
I'm against anything which brings each citizen to a position where they are the servants of the government, because I don't think that it's the government's job to ask me to prove that I am who I am, okay? Because that is altering the position of me versus the government, okay?
So it's a philosophical objection, basically.
It's a philosophical and practical objection. The practical objection is that many of the people who are associated with the campaign, many of them have either come from overseas or have friends and associates from overseas, and they've seen that governments tend, as a matter of human nature, to take advantage in the long term of these opportunities. You don't give governments these opportunities unless there's a very good reason. Australia had an identity card in World War II. Why did we have it? Because we're in a time of national emergency, we had food rationing, we had conscription. Okay, we had that for a specific purpose. What did we do when World War II ended? We got rid of it because we realised that there was no need to have that sort of government intrusion unless there was a national emergency.
But Anna Johnston, a former New South Wales Deputy Privacy Commissioner and now head of the No ID Card campaign, says it isn't only ideology. She says a classic privacy breach is where an estranged husband somehow finds out his ex-wife's new address, and the woman is then forced to go through the trauma and expense of having to uproot her life again. And Johnston says there's a common argument that if you've done nothing wrong, then you've got nothing to hide. But according to her, that's too simplistic.
I think that attitude is fine until people start to realise that everybody has something to hide. You don't write your PIN to your bank account on your ATM card because you don't want a burglar to find it out. So you've got something to hide, the PIN on your bank account. You don't want the keys to your identity the same way. You don't want that disclosed to every man and his dog. Everyone has something to hide. They have their own identity to keep secure. And I think everyone ultimately wants a kind of private space and private time in their life and control over how much information about themselves they give away to others. And ultimately, I think that's what makes us human and makes relationships work. You decide, I'm going to have a relationship with this person. I will give them information about me, but I'm going to remain a stranger to this other person. And I will get to choose how much about myself I tell the supermarket clerk versus my next door neighbour versus my doctor versus my spouse.
Background Briefing's coordinating producer is Linda McGuinness. Technical operator, Mark Don. Research and website, Anna Whitfeld. The executive producer is Kirsten Garrett. Thanks also to Wendy Carlisle. I'm Sharona Coates. You're with ABC Radio National.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.